Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They're all the same. They're all financed by the North Americans. They're all backed by the capitalist media, who accumulate their capital through savage capitalism.
Nicaraguan presidential frontrunner Daniel Ortega. The Bush administration's openly opposed the Sandinista leader's candidacy. We'll speak with a Nicaraguan attorney who was imprisoned by Somoza, the dictator the Sandinistas overthrew 20 years ago, and with an investigative journalist who helped expose the Iran-Contra scandal. Then a former Haitian death squad leader living in New York has been ordered to pay $19 million to three women who survived rape committed by troops under his command. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. NATO is being accused of committing the worst single killing of Afghan civilians since the U.S.-led invasion of 2001. Government officials told the Associated Press between 60 and 85 civilians died in NATO attacks in Kandahar province earlier this week. NATO maintains the dead were militants, but says it's investigating. The news comes less than a week after NATO killed nine Afghan civilians in another airstrike on Kandahar. In Iraq, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is denying the Bush administration's claim he's agreed to several benchmarks aimed at bringing stability and security. Maliki says no timetable has been reached and that he would not accept one on his sovereign government. His comments come one day after U.S. Ambassador Zameh Khalilzad said Iraq had accepted a timeline on meeting several goals, including dealing with militia groups and solving disputes over the Constitution. But in an apparent reference to the Republicans' woes ahead of next month's midterm elections, Maliki said Khalilzad's statement is a result, quote, of elections taking place right now that do not involve us. Maliki also criticized a U.S. raid on Sadr City that left at least six dead and more than 20 wounded. Maliki says he had no prior knowledge of the attack and is demanding an explanation. Just hours after Maliki spoke, President Bush addressed the situation in Iraq at a news conference at the White House.
We're pressing Iraq's leaders to take bold measures to save their country. We're making it clear that America's patience is not unlimited. Yet we also understand the difficult challenges Iraq's leaders face. And we will not put more pressure on the Iraqi government than it can bear. The way to succeed in Iraq is to help Iraq's government grow in strength and assume more control over its country as quickly as possible.
President Bush also addressed the mounting opposition to the war. Bush suggested calls for withdrawal have been influenced by what he called enemy propaganda.
Not allow our dissatisfaction to turn into disillusionment about our purpose in this war. We must not look at every success of the enemy as a mistake on our part. Calls for an investigation are a reason to call for our troops to come home. We must not fall prey to the sophisticated propaganda by the enemy.
Meanwhile, in Iraq today, the U.S. military has announced deaths of five U.S. troops. This month's U.S. death toll is now at 96, the highest total this year and the fourth highest since the war began. Here in the United States, the Supreme Court of New Jersey has ruled gay couples are entitled to the same legal rights as married heterosexuals. The ruling could make New Jersey the second state in the nation to allow gay marriage. Lawmakers will have 6 months to decide whether state law should allow same-sex couples the right to marriage or the right to civil unions. The ruling was approved by a vote of 4-3. The dissenters say they voted against the ruling because they believe it doesn't go far enough. The three judges say the ruling should have asserted gay couples' fundamental right to marriage rather than leaving it to lawmakers. Vice President Dick Cheney has apparently confirmed U.S. interrogators engage in waterboarding, an outlawed practice that creates the sensation of drowning. The admission came during an interview on a right-wing North Dakota radio program Tuesday. Cheney said he agreed with a listener's comment that terrorists should be dunked underwater if it could save American lives. Cheney added, quote, "That's been a very important tool that we've had to be able to secure the nation." spokesperson denied Cheney had endorsed waterboarding and said he was referring to broad interrogation procedures. Waterboarding is barred under international treaties that prohibit torture. In Germany, the magazine Stern is reporting German intelligence officials witnessed the torture of detainees at a secret U.S. detention center in Bosnia just weeks after the 9/11 attacks. The development is the latest to contradict the German government's assertion it only heard of the secret prisons after the story was exposed last year. A leaked intelligence report says the German agents watched an American interrogator beat a 70-year-old prisoner with repeated rifle butts to his head. The interrogator appeared proud of his actions. One of the German agents reported he felt as if he'd witnessed a war crime, saying, quote, "The Serbs ended up before the International Court in The Hague for this kind of thing." In other news from Germany, the military is reeling from the publication of photographs showing German soldiers in mocking and sexually explicit poses in front of human remains in Afghanistan. The images were published Wednesday on the front page of the German newspaper Bild. One photograph shows a soldier holding a human skull next to his exposed penis. The publication comes as the German military is also facing allegations members of Special Forces Unit assaulted a German prisoner while he was being held by U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The prisoner, Murat Kurnaz, was released from Guantanamo last month. At the United Nations, the foreign ministers of Venezuela and Guatemala are expected to meet today in attempts to resolve the stalemate in their race to assume Latin America's open seat on the Security Council. Guatemala leads Venezuela after 41 rounds of voting, but is yet to attract a two-thirds majority. Guatemala has reportedly dismissed Venezuela's proposal to choose Bolivia as a compromise candidate. A meeting Wednesday between the country's ambassadors to the UN failed to reach a solution. On Wednesday, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said his government was open to another candidate so long as it was independent of the United States.
They suspended the vote for a few days until today. They called a meeting, and someone said the two candidates will have to be withdrawn to find a consensus candidate. They proposed another country that I'm not going to name, but it was another country whose government will do what the U.S. government tells them. No, we will not accept that.
In other news from the United Nations, the Bush administration voted Wednesday against a General Assembly resolution to prevent an arms race in outer space. The U.S. was alone in its opposition. 166 countries voted to support the measure, while Israel abstained. The vote comes on the heels of this month's release of the administration's new national space policy that rejects future arms control agreements and asserts the right to deny access to anyone, quote, hostile to U.S. interests. In Argentina, prosecutors have asked a federal court to issue an arrest warrant for former Iranian President Hashemi Rafsanjani for the bombing of a Jewish cultural center that killed dozens of people 12 years ago. Prosecutors say the attack was planned by Iran and carried out by members of Hezbollah. Iran's government has long denied any involvement. In Nigeria, a group of villagers in the Niger Delta have seized three platforms owned by the oil giant Shell. The villagers have shut down three pump stations in protest of Shell's practices in the region. The development comes as a new report from a group of conservation, environmental, and government experts warns the Niger Delta is now one of the five most polluted areas on the planet. The report says up to 1.5 million tons of oil have been spilled into the Niger Delta over the last 50 years. The spill amounts to 50 times the pollution caused by Exxon Valdez tanker disaster in Alaska. And finally, another prominent Muslim has been blocked from entering the United States. Adam Habib, executive director of the Democracy and Governance Research Program for South Africa's Human Sciences Research Council, flew into New York's John F. Kennedy Airport last weekend. He says he was detained for several hours and questioned about his views on terrorism. U.S. border agents eventually canceled his visa and put him on a return flight to Johannesburg. Habib was part of a South African delegation that came for meetings with the World Bank, the National Institutes of Health, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Habib is at least the third known prominent Muslim to be barred entry in the last week, following Fazlur Rahman Azmi of South Africa and Kamal Helbawi of Britain. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our viewers and listeners around the country and around the world. Election monitors from the Organization of American States have warned the Bush administration not to interfere in the upcoming presidential election in Nicaragua. The Bush administration has openly opposed a frontrunner, Daniel Ortega. The Sandinista leader is trying to regain power for the first time since 1990. The OAS singled out Paul Trevelli, the U.S. ambassador to Nicaragua, and U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez for meddling in the November 5th election. In recent weeks, a number of current and former U.S. officials have warned about the consequences of an Ortega victory. On Thursday, Oliver North traveled to Nicaragua and said a victory by Ortega would be, quote, the worst thing for the country. North is a former White House aide who was at the center of the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s when the Reagan administration secretly helped arm the Contras to fight Ortega and the Sandinistas.
Last week, U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez said an Ortega win could scare off foreign investors and jeopardize Nicaragua's participation in CAFTA. 3 weeks ago, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld visited Nicaragua but denied he was meddling in the election.
I don't get involved in politics in the United States, so you can be certain I'm not going to get involved in politics in Nicaragua.
Last month, Republican Congressman Dan Burton also visited the country and warned that foreign aid would be cut off if Ortega was elected. Criticism of the interference from Washington is increasing. Over 1,000 U.S. citizens recently signed an open letter to the U.S. Embassy in Nicaragua. It read in part, quote, "The United States cannot claim to support free and fair elections while it attempts to control and manipulate the voting in Nicaragua." The open letter was published as an ad in two of the country's largest newspapers. Meanwhile, Daniel Ortega has criticized his opponents as being too close to Washington.
They are all the same. They are all financed by the North Americans. They are all backed by the capitalist media, who accumulate their capital through savage capitalism. That is who they are backed by. They are all taking over and delegating themselves and saying they are going to be the best administrators to those that have forced savage capitalism on Nicaragua.
On Wednesday, Nicaraguan attorney and human rights activist Vilma Nunez testified on Capitol Hill about the U.S. role in Nicaragua. In the 1970s, she was held as a political prisoner during the Somoza dictatorship. Vilma Nunez became the first female judge in Nicaragua, now serves as the president of the Nicaraguan Center for Human Rights. She joins us now from Washington, D.C., together with Catherine Hoyt, who will help with translation. Catherine is the national coordinator of the Nicaragua Network. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
No, bienvenidos a Democracia Ahora.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about why you've come to Washington, D.C. and spoke on Capitol Hill?
Si nos podría hablar del por qué usted vino a Washington y por qué habló ahí en el Capitolio ayer.
Sí, muchas gracias. En primer lugar, yo estoy en Washington asistiendo a las sesiones de la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos que recién terminaron anteayer.
First of all, I'm here in the United States for the meetings of the Inter-American Human Rights Commission of the OAS, of the Organization of American States, and those meetings concluded yesterday.
Entonces nos pareció oportuno y contando con el apoyo de amigos de la solidaridad con Nicaragua, como Catherine, como el Centro Quijote, tuvimos la ocasión de intercambiar información y presentar nuestros puntos de vista acerca del papel negativo que está jugando la intervención, el injerencismo norteamericano en las próximas elecciones de Nicaragua. A celebrarse el 5 de noviembre,
and
y
so
concretamente,
with the help of U.S. solidarity like the Nicaragua Network and the Quijote Center Quest for Peace, we thought it was an opportune time to present the situation in Nicaragua of the negative influence, interference of the United States in the elections in Nicaragua, which will be happening on the 5th of November.
Sí, hablar de la injerencia de los gobiernos norteamericanos en Nicaragua no es nada nuevo. Esto ya es histórico.
Sin embargo, speak of interference of the United States in Nicaragua is nothing new. This is all of our history.
Sin embargo, consideramos que la forma como se está llevando a cabo este injerencismo de cara a las próximas elecciones no tiene precedentes.
Nevertheless, we feel that the interference that we're seeing now with these upcoming elections has no precedent.
Aparte de la llegada permanente con mensajes intimidatorios, con mensajes del miedo, con mensajes amenazantes de los diferentes funcionarios del Departamento de Estado y de otras instancias que ustedes mencionaron en su intervención, es verdaderamente inaceptable, violatorio de la Convención de Viena y del comportamiento normal que cualquier representante diplomático debe mantener en un país, el comportamiento del embajador Trivelli.
We would want to say that besides the intimidating and threatening statements of the public officials that you listed in your introduction, we feel that Ambassador Trivelli, in his actions and statements, has gone far beyond the diplomatic rules established in the Vienna Conventions, which govern the relationships between countries.
Vilma Núñez, can I ask you about the... I'd like to ask you, what have been some of the specific actions that the U.S. ambassador has taken in Nicaragua that have you concerned?
Sí, bueno, el embajador Trivelli ha precisamente hecho declaraciones muy, muy fuertes descalificando a varios de los candidatos, específicamente al candidato José Rizzo del Partido Liberal, a quien llama delincuente.
So the ambassador, for example, has made very strong negative statements about, for example, the candidate of the Constitutional Liberal Party, José Rizzo, whom he classifies as a delinquent.
Mm-hmm. Y descalificando también e insultando a Daniel Ortega, candidato del Frente Sandinista, a quien le imputa los mayores epítetos y las mayores descalificaciones que ustedes pueden imaginarse.
And also the candidate of the Sandinista Front, the FSLN, Daniel Ortega, to whom he attributes epithets of the strongest kind.
Pero su comportamiento va más allá, porque prácticamente ha adoptado como la candidatura oficial del gobierno de Estados Unidos, del Departamento de Estado, la candidatura del señor Eduardo Montialegre. O sea, no solo dice estos candidatos tienen tales o cuales problemas, sino que dice hay que votar por este candidato, o sea, por Montialegre.
And
por...
so the Trivelli has not only said you can't vote for this candidate and you definitely shouldn't vote for that candidate, but he has selected a candidate and says that people should vote for Eduardo Montialegre.
Porque de lo contrario sucederán, la política norteamericana impulsará una serie de acciones o dejará de impulsar otra en Nicaragua, y eso genera temor, eso genera definitivamente incertidumbre y violenta la voluntad y la conciencia de los nicaragüenses, que no van a tener la oportunidad de votar libremente, sino presionados y coaccionados por el miedo a que se repita una intervención como la que se desarrolló en los años 80 en contra de la revolución nicaragüense.
So the Nicaraguan people are not going to be able to vote the way they would like to vote because they fear that the United States, because it's threatened either to do something or not to do something, to take something away from the relationship between Nicaragua and the United States, they fear a repercussion similar to what happened in the 1980s with the Contra War.
Pero además el embajador Trivelles se desplaza por todo el país contactando y tratando de incidir y condicionar la voluntad de muchos actores que están involucrados en el proceso electoral. Él incluso ha llegado a buscar cómo influir sobre algunas organizaciones que están realizando a nivel nacional observación en las próximas elecciones.
So Trivelles has gone around from town to town, interfering in the local actions around preparing for the elections, and even has tried to influence the observer groups.
Can you talk about the significance of both Defense Secretary Rumsfeld going to Nicaragua and Oliver North?
Secretario de Defensa Rumsfeld y el viaje del Oliver North a Nicaragua.
Sí, bueno, en primer lugar, después de los antecedentes y el comportamiento de otras listas de funcionarios que han desfilado por Nicaragua, con el propósito, dicen ellos, de unir a las fuerzas democráticas.
After the trail of different U.S. officials that we've had that have come through to Nicaragua making interventionist statements.
Así es que todo el mundo estaba preparado para escuchar otro discurso intervencionista de parte del señor Rumsfeld.
Everybody was prepared to hear an interventionist statement from Secretary Rumsfeld,
quien llegó a Nicaragua para asistir a la conferencia interamericana sobre de ministros de defensa.
He came for a meeting of the ministers of defense of the Western Hemisphere.
Bueno, yo no sé si pudo él ocultar el ambiente, vio que no le convenía y definitivamente se limitó a participar en la conferencia y expresamente dijo que no iba a opinar sobre la política de Nicaragua.
He must have felt the atmosphere in Nicaragua and decided that it wasn't a good moment for him to speak, and he said that he would not comment on Nicaraguan politics.
Aunque sabemos que definitivamente a niveles privados estuvo haciendo prácticamente un trabajo similar al que han hecho otros funcionarios.
But we do know that in private he has been doing the same kind of work on the subject as other U.S. functionaries.
En cuanto a la presencia o a la participación del señor Oliver North.
And as for Oliver North?
Un funcionario completamente desafortunada su imagen y su presencia en Nicaragua por sus antecedentes.
He is a particularly unfortunate person to visit Nicaragua because of his past.
Prácticamente su comportamiento al llegar a tratar de rescatar a uno de los candidatos que el Departamento de Estado, el embajador Trivelles y otros funcionarios han descartado abusivamente, entonces también está interviniendo en los asuntos internos de Nicaragua.
He also is intervening in the internal affairs of Nicaragua by coming in to try to rescue a candidate that Ambassador Trivelles and other State Department officials have pushed aside.
Y metiendo miedo. Es la política del miedo la que el mensaje de este señor lleva a Nicaragua. Porque incluso su sola presencia nos recuerda precisamente todas las atrocidades que se cometieron durante la guerra que patrocinó los Estados Unidos en contra de Nicaragua.
So his very presence inspires fear, and that was his goal, was to put fear into the hearts of the Nicaraguan people, remembering what happened in the 1980s in the war against the people of Nicaragua.
And Catherine Hoyt, I'd like to ask you, as a member of the Nicaragua Solidarity Network, the work that Americans are doing here to try to have an impact or counter these moves of the Bush administration in terms of Nicaragua.
Yes, we with other organizations, including the Quixote Center Quest for Peace and a group of U.S. citizens also in Nicaragua, have been trying to get the word out whenever there are interventionist actions. And we also sponsored two delegations to Nicaragua. And there's a report from the first one on our webpage, www.nicanet.org, that people can read. And we published, of course, those two ads in the Nicaraguan newspapers to try to get the word out to the Nicaraguan people that we repudiated the intervention of our government and they should vote their consciences.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Judge Vilma Nunez, former justice of the Nicaraguan Supreme Court. She had been imprisoned under the dictatorship of Somoza. And also Catherine Hoyt, who heads up Nicaragua Network, translating for the judge. Thank you both. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll continue to talk about Nicaragua. And we're going to go back to the man who helped expose the Iran-Contra affair 20 years ago. We'll speak with reporter Bob Perry. Stay with us. Nicaragua, Nicaraguita by Carlos Mejia Godoy. Mejia Godoy is the running mate of Edmundo Jarquin in the Nicaraguan presidential elections and a dissident Sandinista ticket. The Ortega campaign uses the songs he wrote for the Sandinista revolution. Carlos Mejia Godoy is the father of Camilo Mejia. He is the Florida Army National Guardsman who went to Iraq, came back, and then refused to return. He was the first U.S. soldier to be imprisoned for refusing to fight. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations in this country, as well as across Canada, Australia, and Europe. We also are broadcasting on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are in Spanish, in audio and transcript form for stations to take around the world. As we continue our coverage of Nicaragua, investigative journalist Robert Perry joins us now, also from Washington, D.C. In the 1980s, he helped expose the Iran-Contra scandal while working as a reporter for the Associated Press and for Newsweek. Robert Perry now runs the website consortiumnews.com. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Can you talk about Nicaragua now, 20 years later? In fact, if you were doing your reporting today, it looks like you'd be reporting on the very same people.
Well, many of the same people, certainly. We haven't seen a lot of change. And certainly the history that we covered back in the 1980s remains very relevant. The fear that was engendered through the Contra War is still very much alive in Nicaragua.
And the visit of Oliver North, who is has resurrected himself now as a talk show host, and could you talk a little bit for those of our listeners who perhaps don't recall or were a lot younger at the time, the role of Oliver North in the Nicaraguan Civil War?
Well, Oliver North was a very energetic, aggressive Marine officer. He was assigned to the National Security Council staff during the Reagan presidency. He became a kind of cult figure within the right, even sort of behind the scenes. He was the guy who was putting the muscle behind the President Reagan's efforts in Nicaragua. First, when the CIA was involved directly in the early part of the 1980s, North was one of the people that coordinated matters back with the White House in the field and with the CIA. He then, after the CIA was ordered to stop supporting the Contras by Congress, Oliver North took this program underground with President Reagan's approval, and still really working with many of the intelligence people in the field. Many of the CIA people were then suddenly working for him, at least coordinating through him up into the White House. So he became even more of a legend in Washington. He was a person who was able to pull together a number of these elements. He helped raise money for the Contras. He helped arrange for their weapons flows to go into them. All this while the White House was denying it was doing it. Remember, Congress was very much asleep at the switch. The House Intelligence Committee failed to follow up on some of the early reporting that we were doing and others were doing. So North became increasingly a central figure. And a controversial one. And then when he was finally exposed for what he was up to in the fall of 1986, it was also shown that he was involved with the Iranian arms for hostage deal, since he also had as a portfolio the issue of terrorism. So he was working both the Iran side and the Central America side, and with the money funneling between the two, he was able to, it gave birth to the Iran-Contra scandal, the fact that there was money coming from weapon sales to Iran that was then being sent to the Contras. But there are other money flows and other arrangements of weapons that he was also handling for the Contras.
Wasn't there some indication that he had more than a passing interest in drug trafficking as well in that area?
Well, the Contras became involved in drug trafficking in the 1980s. It was done partly to help raise money for themselves. They were in a very unique position, working with the United States government on one side and then also becoming a way for South American drug dealers to move their supplies, their material, the contraband up into the United States. So because the Contras became an intermediary for that, they also had some protection because they were working for the U.S. government. And the U.S. government was very hesitant to blow the whistle on them. So we now know, based on investigations that went on into the late 1990s, that many of the Contras, really dozens and dozens of them, were implicated in this way. And the U.S. government turned a blind eye because it did not want the negative public relations that would have come from admitting that the drugs were being brought to the United States through the Contras. And Oliver North was one of the people who was aware of this problem and essentially didn't do much about it. He was a person who may have used it against some of the Contras he didn't like in terms of trying to expose them and embarrass them, but he allowed other elements of the Contra movement to go ahead with this program.
Robert Perry, you attempted to expose the whole story. You wrote pieces that didn't get published. You worked for AP, then you worked for Newsweek. In a nutshell, can you explain what you learned, how you ended up leaving AP, going to Newsweek, and even then couldn't do the kind of expose you felt needed to be done on the Iran-Contra scandal?
Well, there was a lot of resistance to any of this kind of reporting in Washington at the time. The Reagan administration was extremely aggressive in going after journalists who were digging into these areas. These were extremely sensitive areas. They were both politically sensitive and legally sensitive. So it was hard for journalists to do this work. There were a number of journalists in the field in Central America who were doing courageous work, people like Ray Bonner of the New York Times, who had been digging into the human rights problems in El Salvador in particular. And he was his career was very badly damaged, and he was made as sort of an example of what happens to you if you go into these areas too aggressively. Some reporters said that they were warned off from going after the North story because that was seen as a career ender. At AP, we continued to push that. I was working with Brian Barger during some of this time, and were able to find out an awful lot of information that Miami Herald did some good work. So those stories were hard to get out because the White House was denying much of it. There was a sense that we were perhaps taking the AP into some dangerous territory. But I think most of our stories, in some form or another, did get out. Basically, I left AP because after the Iran-Contra scandal finally broke, I was approached by Newsweek and offered a job there. And I felt, you know, there'd been so much, there were a number of, there was a lot of controversy with the stories inside the AP that I had been doing. So it just seemed like the right time to leave. So I went to Newsweek, but there I found the same kind of problems, perhaps even more so, where there were senior editors at Newsweek who did not want to see these stories pursued aggressively. And they were very happy to accept a kind of a series of cover stories that were put out for the Iran-Contra scandal. In effect, after Oliver North was finally exposed in 1986 as having played the central role, the cover story became that it was essentially a rogue operation that he and a few men of zeal had been conducting. That wasn't the case either. It had really been approved by President Reagan, deeply involved Vice President Bush, involved the Central Intelligence Agency from the director, CIA Director Casey, down to people in the field, station chiefs, Joe Fernandez, for instance, in Central America. So it was really, it was still a government operation. It was just being done illegally. The problem was that both the Democrats and the Republicans did not really want that pursued too fully. There was a sense among the Democrats that they were happy to accept the cover stories because otherwise they might have to impeach President Reagan, because President Reagan was doing much of what we're now seeing happening in this Bush administration of going beyond the normal constitutional boundaries in trying to conduct wars, even when there are laws prohibiting these things, but still doing it anyway. And Congress didn't want that fight. The Democrats really did not want that fight in the late 1980s. And so it never got fully pursued. And when Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh did take it further and broke through many of the cover stories, he was not well received for doing that. There was a tremendous feeling in Washington, just let it go. It's old history. We have other things to worry about in the nation's capital. The Cold War was kind of an explanation for all this. And when the Cold War ended, there was a sense of let's just forget that old history.
Well, Bob, some of those key figures who were involved back then are still around, and now they're in the new administration, and some of them, Negroponte, Abrams, can you talk about some of these folks and their role then and how they have now been resurrected once again in the Bush administration?
Well, John Negroponte was, of course, ambassador to Honduras. He was a conservative. He'd been a hardliner. He'd been in Indochina during the Vietnam War. He'd worked for Henry Kissinger. But he was considered more of a hardliner than Kissinger. And he helped put together the Contra movement, which is based in Honduras in those early years. And many of the early problems with the human rights violations, the Contras were essentially going into Nicaragua and killing people. It was kind of a terrorist organization. They were committing torture. They were executing Nicaraguan civilian officials. They were torturing people. They were killing Nicaraguan soldiers they'd captured. And this was all being done with the understanding and the protection of the U.S. Embassy in Honduras, where John Negroponte was the ambassador. So he knew a good deal about this, exactly all the details. No one's ever quite sorted that out, but he was certainly deeply involved. Elliot Abrams was at the State Department in those years. Elliot represented sort of the neoconservatives as they were sort of beginning to take shape in the early 1980s. And these were bright young guys who basically felt they were smarter than pretty much anybody else. And their idea was to how do you manipulate the American people to get them to support these kinds of operations. Many of them also had learned from the Vietnam era that you had to control the American population. So they developed these concepts they called perception management. And the idea was to manage the American people's perceptions about events, not tell them the truth necessarily, but exploit certain pieces of information and manufacture some propaganda and use it domestically to keep the American people in line. So that was sort of their thinking and what they were contributing to this. They had a group at the State Department called the Public Diplomacy Office, and that office was headed by Otto Reich, another hardliner, who went after the Washington Press Corps quite aggressively, tried to get people fired or reassigned if they were causing trouble. And those kinds of strategies did not die with Iran-Contra. They just continued. And when George W. Bush came into power, not only did many of the people come back, people like Elliot Abrams and John Negroponte, who's now, of course, the Director of National Intelligence, but the concepts came back. The idea of exaggerating dangers, frightening the American people, managing their perceptions. And so much of not only the personnel, but the strategies have reappeared in this period of the new administration.
John Bolton, was he involved?
Well, John Bolton was around. He was not a person that I was dealing with directly. But many of these people were sort of credentialed during this period. They got jobs at sometimes lower mid level of the Reagan administration, and then used that as a way to build their careers and move up. And they came back. Again, some of the lower level people came back in higher positions with under George W. Bush.
Bob Perry, finally, as you look today, 20 years later, back at the Iran-Contra scandal and the difficulty in getting word out about the scandal, the New York Times holding on to the story. Ultimately, it was the Reagan administration themselves, right around Thanksgiving 20 years ago, that admitted much of what happened, which certainly took out a lot of the investigating of it because they were admitting it themselves. How do you make parallels for what's happening today in journalism?
Well, sure. I think there's been a tendency not to be aggressive, and that was a big lesson learned in the 1980s. Many of the reporters who really pushed these stories and went after the hard news had their careers damaged, and many of the reporters who didn't moved up. So you ended up with sort of a kind of a reverse Darwinianism, if you will. I mean, where maybe not reverse, but it was the reporters that played ball when it got ahead, and they became the managing editors of today. So there is a cultural change that occurred with the Washington Press Corps during that period, and that remains with us. This idea of not asking the hard questions, not pushing the edge of the envelope, and we saw that certainly during the run-up to the Iraq War, and we've seen it really continue to today.
Robert Perry, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
A veteran investigative journalist, started the first online investigative magazine at consortiumnews.com. I want to thank you for joining us. Had worked for Associated Press and Newsweek as well. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Libertad de mi pueblo donde al fin se guiará la meta en contra del mal vivido y tendrás esa verdad de haber construido y ya verás que la bondad es el camino para conseguir la paz, esa liberación.
Nicaragua Te Canto, that's the song by Luis Enrique Mejia Godoy, the younger brother of Carlos Mejia Godoy and the uncle of Camilo Mejia, the soldier who refused to return to Iraq and ultimately was imprisoned here in this country. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, a former Haitian death squad leader living in New York City has been ordered to pay $19 million in damages to three women who survived rape and other abuses committed by paramilitaries under his command. Emmanuel Toto Constant led the paramilitary group, the Front for the Advancement and Progress of Haiti, or FRAP, which killed thousands of supporters of former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in the early 1990s. U.S. District Judge Sidney Stein found that Constant was liable for torture, attempted extrajudicial killing, and crimes against humanity. The damage award was entered late Tuesday.
The lawsuit was filed in December 2004 by the Center for Justice and Accountability on the West Coast and the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York on behalf of three Haitian women who submitted claims anonymously due to fear of reprisal. Constant fled to the United States in December of 1994. He lived freely in New York until he was arrested this past July in an entirely separate case, not for human rights abuses, but for committing mortgage fraud. He remains in jail awaiting a criminal trial on charges of grand larceny, forgery, and falsifying business records. Jenny Green is with us now, senior attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
So what happened? How significant is this verdict on the part, this decision on the part of the judge?
I think it's incredibly significant. As you mentioned, Constant was living in Queens, and there were numerous attempts to hold him accountable through different mechanisms. During President Aristide's government, President Aristide attempted to have him extradited to Haiti. There was a lot of advocacy, including by the Haitian community here in New York, to bring attention to who Constant was and what he had done. The extradition request was rejected by the United States government after some public outcry in September 1995. Constant was ordered deported. However, he then went on 60 Minutes and talked about his connections to the CIA. And after that, the deportation order just was ignored.
And just to be clear, when he came into this country, he was held. He was detained for almost a year, right? And then he started talking.
Correct.
And among those, he talked to was Alan Nairn, who exposed particularly those CIA connections. So he's released under Clinton.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So he was released, there were attempts to the Haitian community in New York picketed his house, there were attempts to go to the United Nations, New York City Council, to really put some public pressure on and get him deported. President Aristide continued to try and get him back to Haiti for prosecution. In 2000, he was convicted in absentia in Haiti for a massacre which occurred in 1994 in Rabateau in Haiti, which killed at least 23 people and destroyed 50 homes. Finally, after the military coup, though, in January of 2004, we moved forward with the civil action. So the case was filed in December 2004.
Now, these civil actions, most of the time, the people who are convicted are not to be found or in another country. Here, you have a situation where he's actually in jail. Will this have any kind of impact on possible collection of this judgment?
Well, I think it can have the other result, which is hopefully this creates some pressure that first of all, the criminal case against him, it's a felony case, needs to play out, and hopefully he will then face charges for the human rights violations either in the United States or in Haiti. So that's a huge factor. This case wasn't about the money necessarily for our clients, but for some public accountability, and it's yet to be seen whether there's any potential for enforcement of the judgment, of the civil judgment.
Does he have large cash reserves in the United States? Does he have a bank account that could be attached?
From the indictment, from the criminal indictment, that scheme was for $1 million, $1 million fraud from SunTrust Bank. So it does indicate that he's not a totally impoverished defendant.
Why is he not meeting bail? Why didn't he get out?
It's unclear, the United States has said that he is facing deportation, and so he would be in deportation. He would be in detention regardless. If he would be released on bail, it seems that the U.S. would pick him up and put him into deportation on immigration, and it doesn't seem that detention would go to credit. So if he would have to serve a criminal sentence, that wouldn't count for time served. So, he may be just cutting his losses.
And the significance of being able to bring some of these perpetrators of these crimes against humanity from Haiti to some form of justice, some form of accountability?
this is the first time that there's been a judgment in the United States against a Haitian perpetrator for the crime against humanity of rape, and which is which really moves forward, the public awareness of that issue, and we also hope that it spurs on prosecutions of the paramilitary in Haiti as well. With the new government, there is some hope that there can be some accountability for the past abuses.
Jenny Green, thank you very much for joining us. We'll link to Center for Constitutional Rights to let people know about what is happening and continues to happen in this case. Juan, a quick question before we wrap up the broadcast. A few days ago, we ran your testimony in the town hall meeting here in New York around media consolidation. But there are even further developments now. Can you talk about what's happening in Univision?
Oh, yeah. Well, some people may be aware, NBC announced huge cutbacks in layoffs of its network staff, and at NBC Universal about, I think it's 700 jobs, 5% of its workforce. But one of the things that didn't get much attention is that NBC is planning to shut down. NBC owns the Telemundo network, the Spanish language network, and it's planning to shut down the news programs, local news programs in six major American cities, Phoenix, San Jose, Houston, San Antonio, a couple of other, Denver as well. And it is basically eliminating its local newscasts and doing what Sinclair Broadcasting has done. It's going to focus, create a regional news center in Fort Worth, Texas, and leave only skeleton news staffs in all these major cities. These are some of the biggest cities in America. And these skeleton staffs will send to Fort Worth a couple of news stories that will then be beamed back to those local cities in basically a local news show that is not local. It's largely canned material. So this is a major, major impact of consolidation on the Spanish language news. So in San Jose, in Phoenix, in Denver, the local Hispanic communities there will not be receiving locally produced news. We've got the situation now that is developing with Fox News. Fox News has called on the FCC now to eliminate all regulations FCC regulations over media ownership concentration.
Let's go to the videotape of what happened at the hearing that took place where you also spoke. Monday was the final day to submit comments to the FCC before it considers changing its media ownership rules. Dozens of public interest groups filed comment arguing media consolidation harms the public. The groups included Common Cause, Prometheus Project, Free Press, Consumers Union, Children's Media Coalition, National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters, Rainbow Push Coalition and Media Alliance. Citizens gathered here in New York at a town hall meeting on the future of diversity in the nation's media. Among those who spoke were activists from the hip-hop community. One of them was M1 from the group Dead Prez.
I'm here to represent for African people. I'm here to represent for hip-hop. I don't have a lot to say, but what I have to say is important. First of all, I'd like to pay respect to the father of this culture that I'm a part of, sitting right beside me, Afrika Bambaataa. That's important because I think there's a few things that we do know, and what we do know is that the media in this country is an organ of the state, the ruling class state that controls what we're hearing and what we're seeing. I'm clear on that, so it helps me understand our position. It helps me understand that that this propaganda is part of a war that also exists against the black and brown community. It's not just a war for oil; it's a war for the minds of our people. And I've been a part of this. My group, Dead Prez, has been existing in this hip hop industry for about 12 years now, and I got an incredible education to understand what it takes for the voice of the people to be heard, because ultimately that's what we're trying to do, is let the people's voice be heard. Chiming in live from Brixton, where I'm just in from, and Mexico City, 25 million people, the voice of our people here is extinguished. we are voiceless. The image that's being reported to the people outside of America about what's going on here is false. It's just like my brother Omawale reported from the grassroots artist movement. And I'm here to balance the scales. It's only free voices that will be able to balance the scales. Sirius, I'm a citizen of the air. I'm here to say that we're sick and tired of not having voices that reflect exactly our reality in our community. We're sick and tired of that. And we're also sick and tired of being bombarded with senseless and useless and meaningless messages that don't do anything but drive forward this capitalist machine and get us to spend more and more. That's not what we want to hear. That's not what we want to hear. I work for the people. The streets is my office. I put my ear to the ground and I hear our movement. That's not being reported on radio. That's not what's being seen on the TV. That's what I do, you know, as a social animal. And right now I'm here to say that the word for the day is self-determination. That's what we need, self-determination. That's what inside this meeting, outside this meeting, over our lives, and it's being reflected in what's happening to our brains. What would Huey say on the 40th anniversary of the Black Panther Party? What would Huey P. Newton say? Community control, just like my partner here said. If we ain't talking about complete community control, if we're not talking about the people being able to govern the voices that's coming into our community, our elders, our ancestors, our leaders, like we say in hip hop, let the poppers pop and the breakers break. In other words, let the leaders lead and let that be the filter for what's being heard in our community, the real that need to be heard in our community. You know, basically, I'm going to put it like that. Shout out to the Grassroots Artist Movement, which is an organization that's a union that's unionizing in hip hop to fight for the ownership of our art and our culture. And either that or turn off the radio, turn off that bullshit. Thank you.
M1 of Dead Prez testifying at the town hall meeting on media diversity and ownership in New York.
Yes, and this continues with the News Corp. As I mentioned before, the owners of Fox News are calling on the Federal Communications Commission to throw out all of its media ownership rules. In a filing with the FCC, the company said, quote, "It is beyond question that regulatory intervention is no longer necessary to ensure diversity and localism." Fox joined other large broadcast companies, including CBS and the Tribune Company, in calling on the FCC to allow for large media corporations to greatly increase their holdings. Hmm. And, you know, this is part of the problems I was mentioning with the NBC Telemundo thing. When NBC took over Telemundo several years ago, they promised the FCC that the merger was going to allow them to provide resources to expand news coverage for the Spanish-speaking community in the United States. And now, 6 years later, what they're doing is they're basically dismantling the little local news coverage that there was. And the thing is, as has been pointed out by several Latino organizations in the past week, if this is good, this kind of regional broadcasting that NBC is creating, why isn't it doing it for its English language programming? Why isn't it shutting down the news operations of NBC in Boston and Philadelphia and Hartford and doing a regional newscast from New York City and then beaming into local news to all those cities? Because localism is a clear requirement of FCC laws that local broadcast stations must provide local services. So this mass production of news is a critical question now.
And we should say, Juan, the NAHJ, National Association of Spanish Journalists, is very involved with this and protesting this, and you're the past president of that national association as we wrap up right now. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufo Dokuduz, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich, and Aaron Matei, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are engineers. I'll be headed today to Sullivan Community College in Lac Sheldrake, tomorrow night in Olympia, Washington. Then I'll be in Mount Vernon and Bellingham, Washington, then headed to Vancouver, Canada. And on Sunday, I'll be in Victoria, British Columbia. You can see at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.